This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. My name is Joanna Ebenstein, and I'm the founder of Morbid Anatomy, an organization and community that is devoted to these very themes. Thank you for joining us today. Before we get started with today's episode, we wanted to make a quick announcement. You can now visit the official Memento Morbid online store. Here you can support the show with t-shirts, sweatshirts, stickers, coffee mugs, and more, all of which feature the beautiful logo designed by our good friend, Lauren Seeley. If you'd like to take a look, you'll find everything at mementomorbidmerch.dashery.com. Every purchase helps support the podcast and allows us to keep bringing these conversations to you. During this episode of Memento Morbid, if any names, books, ideas, or artworks spark your curiosity, check out the podcast show notes for more. You'll also find a link to our Substack, which contains imagery discussed and additional content. Today's guest is someone who has devoted much of his life to the pursuit of curiosity and wonder, became co-founder and creative director of an organization devoted to sharing these places with others.
It's a strange kind of mourning because it's not a friend, it's not a loved one, but it is this other thing that occupies such an enormous part of your self, your soul. So yeah, I think I'm still in that mourning period a bit and trying to figure out, like, what do I want to make? What scale and scope do I want it to grow to?
Before we welcome today's guest, we'd also like to make space for your voices. Every episode, we'd like to invite a member of the community to share a memory, an encounter, a question, a reflection, a thought connected with death and remembrance. We call these our offerings.
Hi, my name's Professor Christopher Hood. Since about 2007, I've been researching the Japan Airlines Flight 123 crash of 1985, which is the world's deadliest single plane crash, particularly focusing on the memorialization of it and what it tells us about Japanese attitudes to death and religion and so on. And as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm also British. And I think for British people, an equivalent is Lockerbie in Scotland, above which the Pan Am Flight 103 disaster happened in 1988. Recently been to Lockerbie for the first time in my life. The residents, I don't think, want to be reminded of what happened in 1988. And I just felt at times me walking around with a camera. And so I was a walking reminder and kind of memorial to what they don't want to remember. And I think as I was walking around, I mean, I started feeling, I think, what could be described as a shadow grief. Those who I don't know who lost their lives in Pan Am 103, but a grief in relation to my lost career, lost friendships. And I just found the whole experience very puzzling.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. If you have your own offering, a story, memory, reflection, thought, you can send us a WhatsApp voice note. Just save the number you'll find in the episode description, and you may hear your voice in a future episode. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dylan Turris, old friend and co-founder and former creative director of Atlas Obscura. He's also a best-selling author and a passionate advocate for strange, unusual, and wonderful things around the world. I met Dylan almost 20 years ago through his blog Curious Expeditions, which he ran with his wife, Michelle, while they were living in Budapest. When they moved to New York City, we became fast friends and soon after collaborators. It was very exciting to watch his project Atlas Obscura, which he founded with my other friend, Josh Foer, become a hub for people around the world who shared our peculiar interests in the unusual, the wonderful, and the macabre. Welcome, Dylan, to Memento Morbid. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Joanna. It's nice to chat with you again.
We've been chatting
for almost 20 years, I realized.
That's coming up on
20 years. Yeah.
Yes, I actually went back to my emails and was like, I just looked up Curious Expeditions in my email box and said, when did we actually start emailing?
We, I think we became aware of each other in the way that you did in that era.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, I feel like such an old fogey when I did go down this line of talking, but there was, believe it or not, a magical era of the internet where it did not feel like the brutal hellscape that it sort of feels like now, where, you know, most of the internet in this kind of early 2000s period, call it, I don't know, 2000 to even all the way to 2010 and beyond, but somewhere sort of in that zone, there was like this really blog era internet. The internet was, you know, still in terms of writing on it or producing work for it, it's kind of animated by a bunch of people who had weird specific interests or a weird specific project they were doing. And people would have their blog roles. So on the like right hand side of their WordPress site, you'd have like a list of all the blogs you followed that were like, this is cool and interesting. And I think we may have come across each other first like that and then started communicating in part because Michelle and I, my wife and I were living in Budapest in Hungary. And we were traveling all around, taking photographs and writing about stuff that just kind of interested us. And that included an enormous amount of wax anatomical museums and medical museums and you know, stuff, shared interests between the two of us. And so I assume, I don't remember what our first email was, but I know we were talking before we came back because I remember coming back to Brooklyn and being like, hey, we should actually meet up in person. And like, that'd be cool. Like, yeah.
I remember that too. And also I had lived in Budapest. I don't know if you remember this. Right after college, I lived in Budapest for 6 months. So when I saw you guys were there, that was another really strong connection because not many people have even gone to Budapest, much less lived there. And it's such a special place. So I felt like we already had this deep connection, a shared interest and a shared perspective on what made it interesting and wanting to share it with people in a way that showed how great and interesting the history was and how amazing these images are, right?
Totally. And I think also in that period, there was a kind of, so much of the animating principle of why people were doing the work they were doing, it was not commercially motivated at all because you didn't really have a meaningful way to ever make, you could ask people for donations or this or that, but like
it wasn't people were doing, there was no such thing as an influencer at that time.
There just wasn't sort of the motives were often quite just like pure in the sense that they were, people were just doing whatever the weird thing was they were doing. And so, and it also felt like a kind of tractable world in the sense that like you could just find the people who were in your corner of the internet. Like, this 30 set of blogs, these 30 people.
Totally. These 30 people.
Kind of doing this kind of stuff, and they're each doing a little bit of a different version of it, you know, a different kind of take on it. But like, this is, and then you sort of, you like formed a kind of community around it. And so I think that was,
to what you're saying, I also think it's hard for people who did not live through that time to even wrap their head around how generous and supportive it was at that time. Like, as soon as I started my blog and followed people on my blog roll, I got a welcome email from each person saying, welcome to the blogosphere. We're so excited. You're right. It was not competitive. Yes. It was really about community, like you said. And I always say to young people, it's kind of like the podcast of its time, but it was able to reach more people maybe because the internet was a different place. I hadn't thought about it exactly how you were talking about it.
It just had a different quality to it. And the audiences weren't huge. And like, you could chase traffic, but like, what for?
Exactly. It wasn't even a thing.
And we were also at places in our lives, maybe where we had the, or I don't know about you, but like, I was in a place where I felt like I had a lot of flexibility to also like explore this set of interests, and it felt like there was an audience for it. And I was the audience for it. I was doing it because I was really excited to do this work and learn this stuff, and the animating principle was not what the audience thought. It was just fun to share this stuff with people and other blogs that like were like, oh wow, that's really cool, that's so interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does seem like a more pure time in that way, as you're describing it. And it was really exciting to meet like-minded people, because before the internet, I don't know about you, Dylan, but until I met Evan Michelson, who will be a guest in the future, I had not met a single person in the world who was interested in the stuff I was interested in. Evan was the first person. I remember someone took me to her shop and I was like, oh my God, she actually likes everything I like. You know, like it was very alienating to have these interests when we were young. I don't know about you, but in my community, I had friends who loved me, but they always thought I was a big weirdo too.
I was lucky to meet Michelle because both of us had, I guess you'd call it a morbid streak. And so we shared a certain, you know, interest in this same kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know, like my interests, you know, in high school, honestly, I was like really into graffiti, which is not at all, but I just loved like that was sort of a world that I spent a lot of time in. I kind of loved the urban exploration aspect of it, like the going to places that were like other people didn't go. I mean, that was a through line for me, honestly. Like,
yeah, I could see that.
The stuff we connected around the kind of, I think, you know, some of my sensibilities, like I think we really do share a kind of a set of aesthetic sensibilities and a set of interests. I think for me, the animating principle of our time in Hungary and then later Atlas Obscura, but even before that, like doing graffiti in high school was this feeling of bringing some kind of sense of magic to the world around you, like this sense that there's this stuff out there that is like truly profound and amazing. And maybe that stuff is like found in like an abandoned factory, or it's found like in a dusty medical museum that in Romania that no one's been to in 20 years. But it's like this search for that moment of recognition where you're like, oh, wow, this feels really distinct. And like, anyway, so.
No, I love that. And actually, I wanted to ask you, what did you study in school? I'm so curious to know.
I went to a college called Bennington.
I think we've all heard of that one.
Vermont. It is a small school. It's still only like maybe 700 kids.
Oh, that's
so
small.
So it's small. Yeah. And it's also a school where you'd like to find your own educational path. So I studied the history, creation, and structure of narrative forms, which covers an awful lot of territory when you really think about it. Isn't that like literally every like, you know, it's filmmaking, that's writing, that's
Museums even.
Museums, yeah. In school, I thought maybe I'd become a filmmaker. That was sort of where I went, like leaving high school, going into college. We didn't really have a film pro. It was too small school for a real film program. So like I messed around with this and that. I learned to edit video. I sort of got into that world a bit, made a lot of weird art. It wasn't actually until I graduated college though. And honestly sort of found the early internet, really like came to like start following various blogs. I mean, I have to mention Boing Boing in this, you know,
great thing to mention.
An early, very influential blog space that sort of said like, hey, the purpose of the internet is to be a wondercomer for the strange and the interesting and the creative. And it spanned a lot of different interests because there were many people involved in it. But that sort of started to open me up to a bunch of different interests and directions that I hadn't necessarily pursued before. And I didn't necessarily go to Hungary knowing exactly what we would go looking for. It's just that once we got there and we started and I brought this out of print book.
Weird Europe.
Yes.
Yeah, that was my Bible as well. Totally.
It was the text for Atlas Obscura in a lot of ways.
Shout out to Weird Europe.
Out to Weird Europe.
So good.
It was really good. It was incredibly made. It was like incredibly.
It was well researched. It was simply written. They had little icons. It was brilliant.
Agreed.
Yeah.
So that, you know, there were other influences sort of. And I had worked with who would become my co-founder for Atlas Obscura, Josh. We had done a project based on a project that he was working on called the Athanasius Kircher Society.
Which I loved that blog. Blog I was a huge fan of back in the day.
Yeah. So we had put on a real life event around that and brought all these interesting people. I was in a mode to just like find stuff that just sparked that thing. You know what I mean? And What a joyful, innocent time to have.
I know. We were so lucky. And we could afford it, right? So just to kind of back up for our audience. So Dylan and I met. Dylan and Michelle and I, and hello to Michelle. We became friends. And then I had a very small space in a Brooklyn shared artist space, cooperative artist space, that was $300 a month, which is the only reason we could do any of this. That's another thing that's just unthinkable now, is we could afford to experiment, you know? And then I had staged my first lecture in that space, and I was shocked that it was standing room only. And I thought this was something only I was interested in. And so then a space became available in this shared artist space that was $1,000 a month. And I said, or $800. I was like, the only way I could do this is if I got seven other people to all pitch in, and we could start doing exhibitions and lectures and events. And we did it. I brought you and Michelle in, and a number of other people that have gone on to do their own projects, including Pam, a phantasmophile, Sal, who still leads our Day of the Dead trip, Shannon Taggart, who, you know, so many people have gone on to do such amazing things because we had this space to incubate our ideas, you know, and to try things out.
You that space, and you particularly, I think, became a really important node that brought some of this stuff, like, right, we met on the internet first, and then it just so happened that we moved back to New York, and it was kind of like, oh, we're all here. Like, but that, it really did have that feeling where it was like, oh, this is a little artist community. Joanna, I remember the first time we put on one of our screenings in there, and it was like absolutely packed.
Yes.
And the projector's going, and it is like getting to be like 100 degrees. It's getting so hot. Like, people are about to faint. And I look around and I realize, like, I guess we can say this in retrospect, like, it was a one door room. So you went in through the door, and there wasn't like even then you weren't outside. I was like, oh, we've created like a terrifying death trap. And we were like, we need to figure out how to make a second exit in here, because otherwise this is like quite, dangerous, but also just like unwieldy. It was that we would pack that room.
Yes.
Observatory was the name of
Michelle
this.
Michelle is the one who came up with the name, as I recall.
Oh God, is that
true? We were
true?
Trying so that... hard to come up with a name we could all agree on, and it was Michelle, your wife, who came up with Observatory.
She's good at that. She's good at that.
We did all kinds of stuff in that space. Yeah, a lot of, you know, art shows and screenings and lectures and classes.
Josh Foer, your partner in Atlas Obscura, had a space upstairs. So and then Cabinet Magazine was over there too. So it was this real kind of generative, collaborative space. We were so lucky to stumble into this space and be there at this time when so much was possible. Let's talk a little bit about Atlas Obscura, which is the project you're best known for. And I would love to hear how that, I feel like it came in part out of Observatory, but anyway, I'd love to hear like how that happened. What is it, and how did it become?
So it's interesting. I mean, talking about sort of meeting on the internet, like I said, you know, my first job out of college, I was like worked at an assistant editor, or not even quite. Like, I worked in an editorial house, which edited commercials. And I had a lot of time on my hands at that job. And so I spent a lot of time on the internet at that job. And I was just kind of collecting stuff. There was even a little blog I did with friends earlier, and just sort of starting to be like, oh, this is a space of great creativity. And I would like to be in this space and do stuff with these people. And so I had finished a big editing job. I eventually left that job and became a freelance editor. And my last job before I moved to Hungary with Michelle was for like 6 or 7 months, I edited a documentary about Paris Hilton, which in some interesting ways was like prescient, because it was like about like fame and this idea of this sort of strange change of what fame is, and, you know, but like also was... funded by her like music Sony, I think, was the like, which also was funding her album. So like, wasn't really, anyway, I was like so burnt out at the end of that. I'd seen 400 hours of Paris Hilton footage and whatever.
Oh my God.
And we were planning to move to Hungary. But along this way, I was following Josh's blog on the Proceedings of the Athanasius Kircher Society. Very weird blog named after this Jesuit priest who's sometimes called the last man to know everything. He was kind of a polymath, interested in a lot of different stuff. And so I just reached out. It was an anonymous author. Like, I had no idea who it was. Like, he didn't put his name on it. But I said, hey, like, I really like what you're doing. It's really in line with sort of what I've been researching and interested in, and I'd love to work on something. And we got together, and he said, oh, let's put on an event. And so we put on this event at CUNY, in a big auditorium. It's like a 400-person auditorium.
I was there. It was amazing.
Oh, were you?
I was,
oh, I
yes.
didn't know you were there.
I was there.
I
yeah,
I thought, you were there.
Yeah,
oh,
I was
my
there.
Oh, God.
It was a great, great event.
It was this kind of evening of wonders. We brought this guy, Colonel Joe Kittinger, who at that time held the record for the longest free fall. He basically was part of an early NASA program and like went to the edge of space in a hot air balloon and jumped out. And it's a crazy story. And we, you know, showed this constructed language, Soris Sol.
That was so moving, actually. It was so interesting.
Which was made to be like translated into every. So we did the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet, but it's like they're using this language, which is all sounds like do, re, sol, sol, re, sol, re, do. You can like already tell maybe why it didn't become a working language. It had like seven syllables were the only kind of pieces, but you could translate it into music and color. And so we did all of that stuff, and I built a balcony for it. I remember my friend helped me do this. Anyway, the evening was great. Like, it was a big success. We sold it out. And then I was like, oh, that was incredible. What are we doing next? By the way, I'm moving to Hungary. and that's when Josh and I started talking about Atlas Obscura. We started talking about sort of creating what we first called the Encyclopedia of Wonder or something. Very twee sort of, you know, very twee time in general. But like eventually became Atlas Obscura. While I was in Hungary, I was writing, me and Michelle were writing our blog, Curious Expeditions. And Atlas Obscura wasn't live yet, but I was also doing some of the first writing for Atlas Obscura.
I don't think I realized it went back that far. That's so interesting.
It went back to pre, you know, so we actually built the first site while I was in Hungary, but it stunk and our developer was kind of, we were working with this guy and he was like, I quit. And we're like, ag. So it wasn't until I got back in 2008 that we were like, all right. And then one of my roommates at the time, Adam Varga, was also a developer, a coder, and we said, hey, can you help us with this? And so he then produced the first like working version. So I was working on it in some ways, honestly, probably for at least a year and a half before it went live. It went live in the summer of 2009. Okay. And that was kind of like, we put about, I don't want to say 300 or so, 400, something like that, entries in, because we knew it needed to like have stuff in it. And yeah, we launched with Boing Boing, actually. Like, we did a 2-week like guest blogging project with them. I blogged about poop on the moon, because there's a bunch of poop on the moon, and it's kind of weird because there's like people, because it like, and it gets into this interesting question of space archaeology and like protecting sites, you know, like what do you do about the kind of like moon landing sites? Are they, do we care, or we do anyway? So Yeah, that was that. That was good. And then it was like, from there, it was kind of off to the races.
What happened? Like, can you kind of trace the trajectory of what happened? How it became the phenomenon that it became?
Yeah, this is going to be the cliff notes. We launched in 2009. We found an audience relatively quickly, in part because of that Boing Boing launch. Like, that was a great, amazing place to do that. And so people got it. I like looked at what we put in the site and they were like, oh, I get what you're doing. And they would like put, they would end, because it was a UGC site, so anyone could enter something.
Yeah, do you want to just say a few words for listeners who might not know what it is?
Yes,
Atlas Obscura?
Lots of people won't know. Yeah. Okay. So Atlas Obscura is and especially was we called it a guide to the world's hidden wonders. That was sometimes our shorthand for it. So in a way, it was a travel site. It was a database of places all over the world that were strange, interesting, unusual in some fashion. So that could be, and it really ranged my interests in a lot of ways. So that could be everything from an incredible medical museum somewhere in Europe where it's like, okay, you got to go here. Like, it's not going to be crowded, but it will be amazing. To an abandoned space. There was a lot of more sort of urbex stuff in some of those early years, because that it was just part of my world a little bit. to a roadside attraction. So it spanned sort of multiple categories in some ways that like hadn't really, I mean, again, another shout out that it is deserved is a site called Roadside America, which
predates
Atlas Obscura by many years. They have done a lot of good work. And similarly, actually, I don't know their dates, but Weird New Jersey, which then became their own series. But this was all very American focused, one. And two, especially in Roadside America, very sort of kitsch, tourist trap, large pistachio on the side of the road. Like, they cover a number of things and some really interesting historical stuff, and they're good writers. I really respect those guys. But our site was the whole world and took and put lots of things that kind of hadn't been put together into one big bucket and said, like, if it's really interesting and it's also not in your tourist guide, probably it belongs here. And we especially looked for stuff with a story to tell. So people started putting stuff in. Like 3 months in, someone entered in the living root bridges of Cherrapunji, which are in India, in the northern India, one of the wettest areas in the world. There were these bridges that were grown from the roots of these trees.
Well,
and we could not. At first, we were like unsure whether they were real because there was not like barely another photo of them online.
Mm-hmm.
And the person wrote in basically saying these things are going to disappear because they're being drained for their rubber. There's no tourism. But like they're hundreds of years old. They were grown by the local Khasi tribe there. Mm. And it was just like, there were a few entries like that, which were like, oh shit. Like that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of can't believe that exists. I kind of can't believe I've never heard of that. You know, the gates of hell in Turkmenistan, this like giant burning hole in the middle of the desert. But there were a few things that came in from users early that I think really made us feel like, whoa, we have just scratched the surface. Like, we have no idea in some ways, like what's out there. So the first early years, I ran it really day to day. Josh was not in New York. He was living in New Haven. We were able to form a small team of about six of us, many part-time. We were able to eke out just enough money to pay people something. So it was a business from pretty early on. After the first, I'd say year and a half, when I was like, I got to pay myself. Like, Josh, like, I am working on this, like, more than 40 hours a week. And I, so I was doing other work. I was working as a freelance editor. I had a part-time job at Cooper Union, like, teaching kids how to do video stuff.
Oh, I don't think I knew that. That's cool.
Yeah, so I was paying the bills in some various ways. But then, you know, at a certain point, it was like, the audience was there. So we started to figure out how to make it a business very slowly. That was kind of the first 4 years. Honestly, 2009 to 2013-ish, 12-ish, somewhere in there. And then it did hit a point where I was about to have a kid and like it was hard to get to a place of stability. Like, we could never make enough money to hire a salesperson to like go make more money. So it was always like I was doing all the same. It was always just like, it was, you know, it was very like stick and gum and spit held together. And at that point, we were kind of like, all right, I think we have to do something different because this isn't really sustainable. So then we went and raised money. So that was like first big change. Raised money, hired a CEO, David Plotz. I'm still in touch with David. We didn't always see eye to eye. Like, that was a hard experience for me because I described it at the time that it was like being broken up with by like eight people at once. Cause like suddenly there's like a new boss, you know what I mean? You're like, you're in charge of everything. And then you're like, okay, now this guy's in charge. And suddenly you're like, oh shit, wait, that means like.
That must be so hard when it's your project. I've never really been able to do that myself. That's so hard.
It was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
It was the right thing to do. You know, I think it was the right thing to do. I think so. It was tough for me a little bit, but the business grew from there. And then David left and we hired another CEO. There are many various additional things that happened. We raised some more money. We did a thing with Airbnb about experiences for a while, but then the pandemic happened and that put a kibosh on that pretty much. We started running trips. We ran trips all around the world. We started writing books. Honestly, the first book, which came out in 2016, was probably the biggest moment where we sort of transitioned from a weird, quirky little thing that some people knew about on the internet, something that had slightly more broad awareness. It just so happened that like that book hit some, I can't say that we like I can't tell you how to do it because I don't know quite why it happened. It just hit at the right time. We went all out for a year to like promote that book. We like really went all in, and it all kind of worked. And it just hit it, you know, stuck at number one for quite a while.
That's
and so
great.
Just, you know, that was kind of like, oh, okay, we're in like a different zone now. Of course, along with all that comes like some more corporate-y stuff, some more, you know, you see, it's an interesting thing to watch a project go from truly sort of a passion project with like, you know, the business plan was like things like advertising, ? trips, ? Like, you know, we have this single sheet of lined paper that we like wrote the business plan down on.
That's awesome.
To something that's got like investors and a board.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, and we happen to do this at a time when it's hard to imagine now, but like new media, you know, the BuzzFeeds of the world, the Food 52s, the whatever. There was this kind of clamor and there was a lot of money sloshing around. And so we were able to, you know, participate in that in a way that I think was good and bad. I think in some ways it grew the business and let us do things that we wouldn't have otherwise done. I think in some ways, maybe it doesn't always enforce discipline because like this magic money shows up from nowhere and you're like, okay, great. Like we'll hire some people like, all right, cool. It's a weird world. It was a weird world. I mean, it was, we sort of plugged into this very strange world that existed, I would say, from about 2012 to about 2021 in some ways. Like it had its ebbs and flows over there. And like, obviously the shine was off of new media, even I would say by 2018. But like, there was still this zero interest phenomenon. This is a weird thing to say, but doing this has made me realize how much all of our lives are like downstream of macroeconomics. Your ability to like make art or live in a place or whatever is just so highly tied to these macroeconomic cycles and these like larger phenomenon. And like it's gotten worse in various ways over the years.
Certainly more difficult.
So we survived through many different things. We survived through the pandemic. We hired a third CEO, God, now maybe about a year and a half ago. And that really was the beginning of the end for me and for my co-founder. It became clear pretty quickly that this was not going to work. The business still had legs. We were still figuring it out. I mean, we were still figuring out how big we could be for a long time. There was a real push to grow at a sort of all costs. And then kind of post-21, I'd say, that whole world disappeared. And so I was like, there's no more magic money coming. So you guys either have like a totally successful business or you don't. And then you've got to make some really serious changes to do that. But that's like, okay, like the business had some strong fundamentals, but then, we hired a new CEO and it was just like, oh, this is, this person does not understand what this is.
Well, or that's such a shame.
And so, you know, at that point you basically, you can fight the good fight, which we did. And we made our concerns very known. But ultimately that ended up with Josh and I getting pushed out of the company. A lot of our
it sucks.
And so the Atlas exists. The database is still there. The database is great. You know, you can go use it and find interesting stuff. It's hard. I honestly don't spend a lot of time. I kind of have given it some distance because it's not super good for me to go look at it when I'm not in control and I don't necessarily agree with some of the decisions being made and some of the focus.
I feel for you as someone who has also grown a project and had to trust other people, and not to get into details, but I know how it feels. And when I found out literally last night when I was doing research to prepare for our talk, I didn't know before. And I felt, oh my God, I had no idea. And I've just felt for you because it's just to build something, to have it be your baby, and then to have it someone else be in a position to define what that is for the world is a very painful thing. So I feel for you.
Yeah.
That's all.
It's complicated. Yeah. It is. It is painful. It has been painful. It was painful to go through that, and painful to be, I mean, thing for both of us, our projects, for me, Atlas Obscura, for you, Morbid Anatomy, they have defined not just our kind of working and creative lives for the last 16, for you, 18 years, maybe. I'm trying to think
of like. It'll be 20 years next year,
okay.
Dylan.
Yeah. Yes. And if I go back, actually, when we started, it's probably 18 for me, too.
Yeah. I think you were already doing, I think, Curious Expeditions is the precursor. I mean, you were already.
Yeah. 2007. Yeah. Like, yeah. So
that
like,
magic year.
Like, it spans a big chunk of our lives.
Absolutely.
And I think they were not just work. They were not just creative projects. They become very intertwined.
They're your children, really.
They're a huge part of how you self-define.
Yeah.
Huge part of how you self-define. So that's been an interesting thing for me. Like, some of that had already started to change for me, and maybe did for you too, because as the project evolves or takes different forms, you have to relate to it in different ways. It's not always as sort of fun and pure as it was at the start. You know, mine became a business that was supporting not just me, but like, so, and same. So does yours.
Yeah.
You know, lots of other people. And so it's like, that changes your relationship with it.
Yeah.
But it is strange to be like, truly estranged. Like, I'm still getting used to that feeling. And I feel a very strong pull that I've had to actually be kind of careful about to like fill that, immediately try to fill that void with something else, like some other thing. And I kind of spent some time scrabbling around being like, oh, and I realized like, that's not how it, maybe that's how it works for some, but I was like, I think I need to take a beat and give myself the time to like, let whatever's gonna emerge.
I think that's so wise. That's exactly what I did after when the museum went bankrupt, Morbid Nemi Museum, I had the same thing where I was, part of me was like, oh my God, I'm going to figure out what I'm going to do. But there was a very strong voice in me that was like, not yet. You don't know yet. You need to step away, you know, because the thing you're going to do next, you don't even know it exists yet. You know, like, back to your thoughts, like that you started this talk with about wonder and right. Like, this world that is so unpredictable and so mysterious in so many wonderful ways that you just don't know what might be next. You know, it might be something you don't even know yet.
It's true. And I also, one of the things that was interesting about Atlas, and I do think it held it to the end, and in some ways I think this is true of Morbid Anatomy also, but like, because they started in a different era, I think they held on to some of the innocence of
the
that
joy.
Era in a funny way. Joy, the Atlas was very much this kind of like open, joyful, like the world is full of wonder and surprise and you too can find it. It just feels like we're in such a different cultural moment, and like, I don't want to be an old grouch, but like, not for the better mostly. And so, yeah, I think there's some also realigning, which is like, if you're going to bring a new project into the world, the state of the world at that moment is very influential on what that project is. And I don't know, I don't quite know what that means for me yet. Like, I don't know, but it's been an interesting, it felt like a holdout. It still exists and it still feels like a holdout in certain ways of like a period of the internet and sort of attitudinally that was just more kind of open and
generous,
curious and
generous
joyful
is the
and
word
generous.
I keep thinking of, because it was really about sharing, right?
It wasn't about
glory, it wasn't about money, it wasn't about status and prestige. It was about the excitement of meeting like-minded people through shared interests and sharing you were researching, because you were so excited to share it with people that actually gave a shit, you know, besides us.
And I think sometimes to our detriment, like, we were really slow to really like go after like kind of the social media creator space, even though in some ways that has taken over a lot of that kind of like recommendation zone.
That's true.
Because it felt motivated by stuff that sometimes I was like, I don't know, like, this feels a little different to me. Like, this doesn't feel necessarily always in the spirit. And so sometimes I think our ethos there kind of like, for good and bad, like, pinned us to a previous era.
Yeah.
Well, the media landscape is like always sort of in some, you know, like, dramatic flux and collapse and rebirth and collapse. And
So to everything we've just been talking about, what are you working on, anything right now that you're excited about?
I'm doing some small projects, honestly. Okay. I got a new job, so I have a job, and the
congratulations.
Job is a great job. And I still work in the kind of tourism space. I work representing destinations with a company called Miles Partnership. And so some of that includes creative work of various kinds. So that's good. But like, you know, on the more personal creative side, I don't know. I'm still figuring it out. I've got some small projects that I don't show anybody. I don't have a big next thing yet.
I don't have a big next thing yet.
I don't know. It's anxiety producing. Joanna, it's anxiety
producing. I know because I've been there, but I'm telling you as someone who had moved through it a long time ago, what I can tell you now is, you know, it's like death and rebirth, right? It's like something has to die for the new thing to be born. You won't know what it is until you do, but it's going to be something you can't even imagine right now. And it's going to be great.
I appreciate that.
I mean,
I hope
that's
right.
been my experience. Honestly, I'm not telling you that as some faith thing. It's my experience, you know, and it was a death, you know, like I'm sure you feel it too.
Yes.
When the museum ended, I had to mourn for a long time before I was ready to do something else. As you said, it is like a divorce and it feels horrible.
Yeah. It's a very specific thing. It's a very strange, like it's a strange kind of mourning because it's not, you know, it's like, it's not a friend, it's not a loved one, but it is this other thing that occupies such enormous part of your self, your soul. So I think I'm still in that mourning period a bit and trying to figure out like, what making stuff, what do I want to make? What scale and scope do I want it to grow to? I mean, I think that's another interesting question is you learn the hard way.
I mean, this is something that I thought a lot about in the aftermath of the museum too. Leticia and I, after the museum, started a new mantra, which was slow, steady, sustainable. Yeah. It's not sexy. It's not exciting, but that's what we've been following for the past. It ended in 2016, so God, about 10 years now. It's not as big and it's not as grand and it's steady and it's supported and it feels great, you know?
Yeah. Part of the process is getting to grips with that. Like you don't actually have to recreate the previous thing one for one, right? There's a real danger in that you
totally.
Go, okay, so I'm just going to kind of like, no, you have to sort of rescope the entire, like, okay, like, you know,
I was going to say, and there's pleasure in that too. I think that's the thing we forget, you know, like when you're caught up in that, it feels like that's the only thing, but there's a real pleasure in working with a small, dedicated team that really cares about what you're doing and shares the vision. And you're just doing shit you believe in, but it doesn't need this infrastructure that puts you at the mercy of people that might not think the same way as you do, you know?
Yes.
So there is.
That's right.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm from the other side. I'm just telling you.
It's good to hear. It's good to hear. And I am excited, good. But I got to get there.
I know. Well, where can people who might want to find out more about what you're up to, where can they find out more about you and your future projects?
Yeah, I have a website, but it's kind of just a holding place right now. It's just my name, dylantheris.com. I'm on Instagram and X and various other places. But I think one of the questions I have is like, where and how do I want to do that in this kind of modern media ecosystem? Like, where do I want to build and spend my time? And I don't know, honestly, that it's something that lives on the internet anymore. I don't know. It may be something that lives here in my community with people who are nearby. Like, because I'm not sure that there is a space quite online for what I want to do. I don't know yet. Probably you'd get there. But, I mean, it's funny because we started this talking about my time at Hungry, which was very, like, we moved around, we went places, we saw stuff, we wrote about that stuff. That is how we spent our time. It included spending time like fixing the WordPress code, but like, you know, which I mean, everyone,
I can identify with that.
Everyone of an era remembers how to, you know.
For me, it was Blogger, but yes.
Okay. Yes. Right. Yeah. And then with Observatory, again, this was like, that was like a community space.
Absolutely.
And if you were in that community, you'd come and experience that stuff. And if you weren't in it, and so much work that went on to reach many different people in disparate spaces started in that way.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of having to invite, you know, I spent so long working and making a business on the internet and, you know, as a, and I just wonder if like for whatever comes next, it needs to start like with my feet on the ground. You know what I mean?
I love how you're thinking about this. I think that's super interesting.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. So I have three questions that I'd like to end each episode with.
Okay.
How does the idea of death animate your life and work, if at all?
There are two answers to this question. One is the easy answer, which is from a aesthetic standpoint. I think I've always been fascinated and interested, and so I am drawn to things that deal with death, that present death, that deal with the body. That is true when I was a teenager. It's true now. I think, like, I don't know if there's like a particular gene for it. Like, I am interested. I think in a more personal sense, I wish I could say I had a truly peaceful relationship, but, you know, and I aspire to have such. But honestly, probably anxiety and a feel that like I will run out of time to do all of the things or to you know, some sense of being in middle age and being like, okay, what is still in front of me and what is behind me? You know, like,
absolutely.
So that's the honest answer. That's the less like, oh, I've got it all together answer is like, I don't know, man, I've got 40 years to do everything I want to do. Probably like, can I be chill with that? Like, or is that going to make me just like run around like a chicken with my head cut off? I don't know.
Okay. My next question is, has your work changed your thoughts about death and what might or might not happen after?
Ooh. I don't know that my work has changed it that much, but I have changed. I have changed. I think I was always an agnostic. I mean, I grew up religious.
Did you? What religion did you grow up with?
Well, it was UCC, United Church of Christ. So it was very liberal, hippy-dippy, you know. But I had myself baptized when I was 13.
Wow.
I was, you know.
I didn't know this about you.
Yeah, and my belief, I just didn't participate in the structures of belief, I would say. It's not even that the belief went away or the desire for some spiritual relationship went away. I just didn't build any of that around myself. And so it became kind of fallow, you know, or shallow is a better way to put it.
Yeah.
I have become much more engaged in exploring that space and trying to put some of those rituals and things back into my life. And that may be age, it may be parenthood, it may be, I don't know, but I'm deeply unsatisfied by a kind of like hard materialist interpretation of the world. It is a true dead end, and it lacks so much depth and curiosity. Like, it just kind of like, it doesn't even grapple with it doesn't even grapple with materialist reality in some ways, to
totally,
my mind. Like,
totally.
I can't say I've got it all worked out, but my sense of death is a big open-ended question mark.
I love that. Okay, finally, if you could live forever healthy and young, would you? Why or why not? I love how fast you said that.
No. Oh, what a prison. What a prison. Our mortality animates every moment of our lives. And like, look, it's all good to want to be healthy in your 80s. Like, it's just not like, you know, it's like, go exercise, whatever. Like, it's fine to want to have a long lifespan and a long health span. And like, that's okay. But there is this psychotic energy around trying. I think our mortality is the most important part of being a human in almost every way. And I can't even imagine what happens when you take that away. I don't think it's going to be good. I don't think it's possible, first off, by the by. I think this is bullshit, like snake oil, like whatever. Like, I'm sure longevity research has, there's plenty of positive things that may come out of it. I don't want to be sort of, you know, a reactionary. But like, No, I don't want to live forever. What a prison. I don't like it. There's a reason why like vampires are tortured. Like, we have a lot of myths that like talk about this idea, and the myths are basically like, this is a awful existence.
Yeah.
You become a drain on all others around you and like life itself. I think there's something to that. I think there's something to that. And I can't help but notice that the people who want to become immortal most of all are people who that's the only thing they can't control in their life. Totally. They are already the most wealthy people in the world. They're already some of the most powerful people in the world. I think there is truly something vampiric in that entire pursuit. So all good to research that helps us live long and healthy. Immortality is a whole other ball of wax.
That's a great answer, Dylan. I appreciate that. And I happen to agree with everything you said. So
I thought you might.
I'm always curious to see what people think. It's a really telling question, and we've had all sorts of different responses. I really love ending with it. So I really appreciate what you said. And I think the vampire metaphor is brilliant and very true. All right. Well, with that, I'm going to just thank you so much for being here and for sharing everything that you did. I know it's not easy to talk about some of the stuff, so I appreciate it.
It's a joy. Honestly, it's such a joy to talk to you.
Oh, it's like, always a joy to talk to you too. I know.
Thanks, Joanna.
Yeah, thank you, Dylan. After every episode, my producer, Jess, and I like to just have a little chat about the interview. And I'm always curious about her thoughts because always, so far at least, I've known the speaker very well. I know what we're going to talk about, but so much of it might be a surprise to her. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Jess, and say, what are your thoughts or what stood out for you about this interview?
Lots stood out, and I was really engaged with that, you know, to kind of listening to your conversation. And because you know each other so well, it did feel like in a really kind of interesting way, like you're eavesdropping in this kind of special conversation. So interesting to hear the transition that Dylan's gone through with Atlas Obscura and the way that that has happened and the parallels that you can make with that as well. That was really, and there was lots of things that I'd never heard of that I've written down. Boing boing.
Boing boing was so important when we were young. It was just an aggregator of interesting things on the internet. And they really did want to be kind of like a cabinet of curiosity, a virtual cabinet of curiosity. So they amplified a lot of our voices as well.
So was it blogs specifically? Or?
It was internet in general, but it was also books. It was more just like a storehouse of somebody who was going through and finding all the interesting things in the world and presenting them to you. And the people that did it were great, became friends with one of them, David Peskowitz, who wrote something for our first Morbid Anatomy anthology, and he was fantastic. So just like-minded people who were geeking out on the same kind of things that we were.
And that sounds really nice. Kind of at the end, when we kind of stopped recording, we were speaking with Dylan then. It sounds so appealing in the world that we live in right now to be in a space where rent is affordable to creative people to try things, you know? So you're not so commercially driven. You can be curious. You can try things out. That was kind of one of the overrunning themes that came through for me with that, you know?
We were very lucky. You know, we were lucky with that. And then New York was still expensive at that time, but we were lucky that I met a woman called Sasha Chachkovatsky. I can never say her name exactly right, but she was an artist who had bought space in this big building before things got expensive. And she created an arts incubation space. So her MO was really to help give people a space to generate new things. And it really was. I mean, without that, there would be no Morbid Anatomy today, probably, because with that, I thought, oh, maybe I'll start a little library. I can afford the space. And then we had Observatory, which was something of a phenomenon. You could see it led to Pam Grossman's project, fantastic, or didn't start it, but it was a place where she could kind of refine it and start getting bigger with it. Same with Dylan with Curious Expeditions and Atlas Obscura. Shannon was doing her work there. So it was a real place that I think benefited so many of us in the community. And we were very lucky.
Absolutely. Lots of our previous guests there as well.
Absolutely.
It would be funny to kind of go back to like little Joanna, little Pam, and, you know, kind of like, you know, tell them all the things that you're going to achieve, you know, like in that moment. And just, the way that you describe the internet of being a generous space where you could find your people, that feels quite alien in today's world.
I'm so sorry that it does.
And, but there are other people, you know, there are other ways of finding things and there are good things on there. But then, you know, like Dylan was saying, you know, maybe now he's going to do something in his community, people nearby him. there's actually something to be said about that, I think, about making those connections.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciated too how analytical and rational Dylan is. Like, he has a certain kind of intellect that can look at things systematically that is not my gift, you know? So it was very interesting for me to hear how he thought about that time. I'd never thought about it the way he was talking about it. I hadn't thought about how things had changed. I guess because he stayed in a web space, you know, like Atlas Obscura is a website. He's been forced to kind of to be in that world more than I have. You know, we certainly have our social media and we have a website, but that's not predominantly what we do. We produce content, you know. So it was really interesting just to hear his perspective. And I feel like I learned a lot from him. I also loved his answer to living forever. I wasn't sure how he was going to go because he was already talking about 40 years maybe not being enough. And then he was just so strongly a no. And I thought that was super interesting, too.
Yeah, you hadn't even finished the question. He's like, no. No. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, well, thank you, Jess.
Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and our happenings, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also find us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, or check out our Substack at morbidanatomy.substack.com. Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.